Surely it's good to see everyone here this morning. A rather cold morning, and yet it looks like we have a nice assembly here of folks that who have cars that start. And we're glad that you were able to get out and about this morning and be here safely. And we have this opportunity to worship God together. I'd like to ask you, if you would, to return to the 20th chapter of Matthew that was read for us this morning. In 1976, John Dean wrote a book that chronicled the involvement of he and several others of President Nixon's staff in carrying out the Watergate burglaries and the subsequent attempt to cover up their activities. It is an interesting account of a young man who started out being motivated by ideology. He had been a classmate to one of the sons of Barry Goldwater, and that opened the door for him to become a part of a political White House staff. They soon recognized that power and involvement that they had, which led to pride, which led to their downfall, as they were willing to go to any lengths to protect their interests and to hold on to their power. The name of Dean's book, by the way, was Blind Ambition. And I thought about that when I read from Matthew's account the request that was made of Jesus by James and John. This section is subtitled in my Bible, Instruction About Ambition. You know, sometimes we forget that the men that we read about in the New Testament were just that. They were men, human beings, just like you and I, who were subject to the same temptations as we would be. It is obvious that the men that Jesus chose to be his apostles did not understand the nature of the kingdom that Jesus spoke of. They were thinking in terms of a physical kingdom. They, like most Jews, believed that when the Messiah came, that he would conquer their enemies, as King David had, and reestablish the nation of Israel to prominence. Jesus was hailed as the King of the Jews. When Pilate asked him if he was a king, Jesus said, "You have rightly spoken," but he added then, "My kingdom is not of this world." The apostles failed to grasp the concept of a spiritual kingdom, even after Jesus was raised from the dead. They asked him in Acts chapter 1 and verse 6, "Lord, will you now, will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel?" And so because they anticipated the establishment of an earthly kingdom, they started to wonder what their role in that kingdom would be. And when they thought about their role in that kingdom, because they had a view of a worldly kingdom, they began to be tempted by worldly ambition. When the 10 other apostles heard the request that had been made by the wife of Zebedee for her sons to be given the greatest positions of power and authority in Jesus' kingdom, one of them at his right hand and one of them at the left, we are told in Matthew 20, verse 24, that they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. But certainly it wasn't because all of them had not entertained such thoughts. In fact, Jesus was well aware of the fact that it was often at the center of their thoughts. Matthew chapter 18 and verses 1 through 4, we read that some of the disciples came to him and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" At that time, Jesus responded by setting a little child in their midst, and he said, "Unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself as a little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." In Mark chapter 9, verses 33 through 35, Jesus arrived with his apostles in Capernaum, and he asked them, "What was that you were disputing about on the road?" Well, they kept silent because the matter that they had disputed about was this question about which of them would be the greatest. In verse 35, we are told that Jesus sat down, he called the 12 and said, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and the servant of all." In Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 26, we are told that there was a rivalry among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And so while the others may have been offended by this proposal, they were certainly not innocent in the matter. You know, there may have been another dynamic involved here that we have overlooked. In fact, to tell you the truth, I'd never really given it a whole lot of thought until I read this account from all of the Gospels. Was there anything significant about these two apostles, James and John, asking for special favor? Well, who were James and John? Well, we know that they were the sons of Zebedee. We know that when Jesus called them, that they left their father and their fishing business in order to follow Jesus. We also know that it was their mother who came to Jesus along with her sons to make this request. By looking at the other mentions of the women who followed Jesus, we learn more. Matthew refers to her as the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Mark calls her Salome in Mark chapter 15 and verse 40. John refers to her as Jesus' mother's sister in John chapter 19 and verse 25. And so that would mean then that this woman, Salome, if she indeed is Mary's sister, was Jesus' aunt, and that James and John were his cousins. That being true, and people being people, it may have been that they felt that they were entitled to special favors. Maybe that's the reason why the other apostles were so sensitive about it. And so it is certainly not out of the question that the temptation of worldly ambition threatened to divide this very first band of Jesus' disciples. It was boldly stated, Matthew says, by their mother. Mark's account says by they themselves, that one of them should be at the right hand of Jesus in his kingdom. The other should be at the left. You know, Jesus' response indicated to them that they didn't know what they were asking for. Apparently, they were thinking in terms of power or prestige. Jesus was telling them that the kingdom was about suffering and sacrifice. It was his kingdom, and he knew that for that kingdom, he would have to die. And so he asked them, "Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" Now, Jesus was not talking here about the Lord's Supper. He was not talking about water baptism. He was talking about the cup of suffering. He was talking about being immersed or overwhelmed in the agony of crucifixion. They were looking for something to be given to them for which they had not sacrificed. They were looking for a crown. And Jesus was telling them about a cross. And so they said, being rather clueless, "Yes, we're able." In verse 23, Jesus said, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with my baptism." James very shortly would be. In Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, early in the history of the church, we are told that Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Now John, of course, lived to be of old age, but he suffered the later years of his life in exile. But who could be recognized as being great in the kingdom of God? Jesus said that it was not his to give. He said, "But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give." As a matter of fact, it was more up to them than it was to Jesus because of the meaning of greatness in the eyes of God. In verse 23, "It is for those whom it is prepared by my Father." So Jesus needed to teach them again what the true meaning of greatness is. First of all, he told them what greatness is not. In verse 25, he called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be among you." And then Jesus told them what greatness is. "Whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant." And finally, Jesus pointed to himself as their example. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." This morning, by looking at this text, I believe that we can learn three things about how God measures greatness in his kingdom. First of all, in the kingdom of God, service is greatness. Perhaps the greatest, certainly the most effective lesson that Jesus taught about service was in the upper room that night that he was betrayed, the account of which we can read in John the 13th chapter. Jesus had desired to observe the Passover one last time with these 12 men that he loved and had been preparing to continue on his work for the next or over the past 3 years. But their attitude was both discouraging and disappointing. It was on their journey to this place that they had been disputing about which of them would be greatest in the kingdom. It was on this occasion that Jesus recognized that there was rivalry among them about who was the greatest. So now, when they arrived at this place, the upper room, service was needed. Their feet were dusty and grimy from walking. And before they could eat together, especially in the Eastern fashion of eating, each one reclined against the other, virtually sitting on the floor. They needed to be washed. Now, customarily, washing feet was the task that was given to the lowliest of the servants. That was the problem. There were no servants in the upper room that night, and none of the apostles were going to lower themselves to take that role. And it was then that Jesus arose from supper, laid aside his garments, took the towel, and wrapped it around his waist, poured water into the basin, and began washing his apostles' feet. Now, the apostles were embarrassed and ashamed, not, I think, because they realized that they should have done this. I think they were more embarrassed that Jesus was doing it. They said to Jesus, "You will never wash my feet." You see, they still did not recognize the meaning of greatness in the eyes of God. In Luke's account, Jesus asked, "For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves?" Is it not he who sits at the table? And isn't that the way that we look at things? Who should have been the guest of honor that night? That night would begin the entire ordeal of Jesus' trial and crucifixion. Shouldn't the apostles have been looking for ways to comfort him? But you know, that's what happens when we are so focused on the way others are treating us that we totally miss the opportunity to glorify God by serving others. Jesus said, "Who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves?" Is it not he who sits at the table? "And yet I am with you as one who serves." In John chapter 13, verses 13 through 17, Jesus sat down and he said, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, 'Well, for so I am.' If I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I've given you an example that you should do as I have done for you." You know, service is an expression of love. How could Jesus have shown his love for them in any greater way. Actually, washing their feet was a very small expression of Jesus' love. The full expression of his love would be when he would go to the cross and die for them. But service is an expression of love. That's true in our families. Why does a mother labor over keeping a house and cooking and cleaning and taking care of sick children? Is it because she has all of these duties dumped on her? Or is it because she is expressing her love for the ones that she serves? Why does a man work all day, turn his paycheck over to meet the needs of his family, and then work in the evening to help his wife and spend time with his children? Is it because he is obligated? Or is it an expression of his love? It's true in the church. Jesus, who came to serve, said that we should love one another as he has loved us. We say that we love one another, but what does that mean? Do we really love one another if we are indifferent or unconcerned about one another's needs? John wrote in 1 John 3 and verse 18, "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." And then in 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, the prior verses, John says, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we also ought to lay down our lives for one another." You see, service is love. And love is service. Service is what makes one great in God's kingdom. Service is what wins God's approval. Jesus told James and John, along with the others, "Whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give his life a ransom for many." And so greatness in the kingdom of God is service. A second thing that we can see is that true leadership is service. Verse 25, Jesus pretty well summarizes the worldly attitude toward leadership. He said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you." You know, it'd be wrong for us not to recognize God-given authority. In fact, God, who has all authority, is the source of all authority. Governments have authority over nations because God has given it. Husbands have authority over wives because God has given it. Parents have authority over children because God has given it. Elders have authority in the church because God has given it. But Jesus is clearly stating here that true authority is based on character, not position. God doesn't want anyone to lord it over anyone. A leader is as a leader does. You can call a man the head of his wife, or parents the head of their children, or elders leaders over the church, but if people do not look to you for leadership, then you are not a leader. And the key to people being willing to follow is service. Yes, a husband is head over the wife, but why should any wife be willing to submit to her husband? Well, if he loves her, as Paul speaks in Ephesians 5, verses 22 through 33, if he loves her as he loves his own body, if he nourishes and cherishes her, if he is willing to die for her, if he will make her well-being as important to him as his own, then she will follow his leadership. Elders have authority in the church, but why should any congregation of Christians be willing to follow them? Well, the Hebrew writer says that we should love them for their work's sake. We should follow their faith, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 7. In Hebrews 13 and verse 17, we are told, "Obey those who have rule over you and be submissive, for they watch for your souls as those who must give an account. And so do so with joy and not with grief. That would be unprofitable for you." The elders, Peter wrote in 1 Peter 1, verses 2 and 3, "A shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as an overseer, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." You know, it's interesting that for all the names the Scriptures give for the men who oversee the church, it seems like we have settled on elder. I don't know why that is. It certainly is a perfectly legitimate description of those who serve in the capacity of overseeing a congregation. But of all the names given by those who oversee the church, Jesus chose only one of them to describe himself. He is a shepherd. Peter said of him that he is the chief shepherd. Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd." How does Jesus describe the role of a shepherd? He said the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. His sheep hear his voice. He calls them by name and leads them out. He goes before them, and sheep follow him because they know his voice. You see, sheep will follow the shepherd because they are used to the shepherd loving them. They're used to the shepherd caring for them. David, who himself was a shepherd, has the wonderful psalm that he wrote about the Lord being his shepherd, the 23rd Psalm. And he talks about the things, the ways that the Lord was his shepherd, that he led him to where there was food and water. He protected him. He fed him. He binds up his wounds. He anoints his head with oil. Shepherds lead sheep by serving. A few years ago, I received an issue of a brotherhood paper, and they decided that in this paper they were going to resolve once and forever the issue of whether or not elders have authority in the congregation. And it contains several articles with titles like "The Elders Call the Shots." And I thought, you know, it's no wonder that they're having problems leading. Because true leadership is service. If you have elders who say, "Do as we say because we are the elders," the sheep will scatter. But if the elders say, if the shepherds say, "Follow me, let's serve the Lord together," then the sheep will follow. And if those leaders are truly showing their love, if those leaders are sacrificing, if those leaders are serving, they will be loved. True leadership is found in character, not in position. Yes, worldly leaders, Jesus said, lord it over. They pull rank. They exercise authority. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. Whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your servant. And so we find that service is greatness in the kingdom is service. Secondly, that true leadership is service. The third thing that we find is that the way to find life is to give it away. Isn't that what Jesus said? Jesus said, "He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake shall find it." Matthew 10 and verse 39. There is nothing that the Lord ever asks of us that is not for our benefit. Nothing that he commands that is not with our best interest at heart. Jesus tells us it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. Giving produces greater happiness than receiving. Serving is giving. Jesus, after demonstrating his love to the apostles by washing their feet, Show them the true meaning of leadership by taking the towel. He said, I've given you an example that you should do as I have done unto you. I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. There is more joy and satisfaction. There's a greater feeling of well-being and purpose in serving than any other pursuit in life. Serving others will bring a reward in this life. Remember when Peter raised Dorcas, how the widows and others that she served loved her and how they had brought the things that she had made for them. And they honored her. What was the source of that love? What was that source of that devotion? Dorcas was a servant. And they could show the demonstration of her love and of her service. I can't read that account without wondering that when I depart this world, what will people have to show? What will people have to say? What will people talk about? What will people be able to say meant something special to them? How will they say that I was a servant? How will they say that I demonstrated my love to them? And so there are rewards in this life for serving others, but the greatest reward of serving will be recognized in eternity. In Revelation 14 and verse 13, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on, yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. James said in James 1 and verse 25, he who is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, he will be blessed. This morning, do you want God's approval? Do you want to be great in the eyes of God? Do you want to be loved and appreciated and valued by others? Then be a servant. Lord, make me a servant. Lord, make me like you. For you are a servant. Make me one too. Lord, make me a servant. Do what you must do to make me a servant. Make me like you. The greatest servant of all was the one who came to this earth not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. Jesus died for us. What greater love could ever be demonstrated? Whatever greater desire to serve the needs of man than when Jesus came and died on the cross? The Lord extends his invitation this morning as his invitation is always extended. It may be that you're here as one who's not yet rendered obedience to Christ by obeying the gospel. We want you to know that this is an opportunity that you have. And it is the best opportunity that you will ever have to put on Christ through baptism. This morning, if it is your need to obey the gospel, if there are spiritual needs in your life of any nature, come make them known. Let us serve one another. Let us help one another get to heaven. If you desire to come, please do so while together we stand and while we sing.